Welcome to How to Save Democracy, the podcast for people who love democracy but know it needs to change. I am Omezine.
And I'm John. Today we're coming to you from the podcast studio at the University of Manchester, where both Omezine and I hold fellowships, and we're joined by Johnny Benson, lecturer in political theory here. Omezine and Johnny have been working together on a fascinating project, digging into what happened in Omezine's beloved Tunisia in the aftermath of revolution. Omezine has talked about the revolution on the podcast in the past, and she will again. It's a massive part of what makes her who she is, and there's a lot we can learn from her experience. But you can see this as something of a deep dive into what happened after, and what we can learn for the challenges facing democratic innovation around the world today. I'm going to be asking the questions, and so let's begin. Omezine, let's start just by giving a quick flavour of what actually happened in Tunisia, because that's the starting point for this. What was the role of citizens in the revolution and in the aftermath?
So I spoke extensively about the Tunisian experience and revolution and democratization process in another episode where you interviewed me, John. So if you want to listen to the details, you can go back to it. Today, I would like to focus on the first years, even the first months, to be more precise, of the transition from dictatorship to democracy. It is this historic moment in 2010-2011 in Tunisia, where there was a lot of street protests that ended up with Ben Ali fleeing the country on January 14, 2011. And the role that was given, or the role of people and how it was perceived by institutions. And I think now, looking back after a decade of democracy and now back to authoritarian regime in Tunisia, we missed the point there. We only perceived Tunisian people as voters and protesters, but not as full and active participants in designing the new democracy. We had the influence, and I think it's normal in a transition, to look at established democracies and representative democracy as the type of system to install. But the reality is that even representative democracies have lost the trust of the people, and people are frustrated. And I think people as participants could have added so much. We could have used the energy of the streets, people demanding jobs, freedom, and dignity, to bring that vision into the institution we created, into the political vision of a new contract that Tunisia started to establish then via the first free and fair elections.
So you've taken all of the stories, essentially, that we've been digging up through this podcast and gone and imagined yourself back into that time and going, what might have been possible if we'd had these approaches, these democratic innovations, these ways of involving people available to us if Tunisia had drawn on those things at that point. Is that right?
Yeah, it's right. And I've been in dialogue with Johnny Benson, our friendly academic, as you call him, who's a specialist really in political theory and democratic skepticism, to see that, you know, how we can look at what happened during those days, and if really, like my idea of missing the point of treating people as citizens can make sense in terms of democratic innovation, and try to analyze what didn't work, because we had things that work, right? Like strong elements that made us establish the foundations of a new democracy, but and we missed some points, and see if democratic innovation practices could have brought the solution that would made us stronger, that could have made the checks and balances resilient to the steps back to authoritarianism.
So really what we've got here is a picture where we're looking back to 2010, 2011, this moment of revolution, the excitement and the energy of a protest built around that call for jobs, freedom and dignity. And then, I guess what you're saying is sort of the creation of a democracy on almost a kind of Western model, and then the promise of that not quite being fulfilled, and disillusionment rising, and then back to authoritarianism.
I think a lot of people won't be happy to hear that it was on a Western model. This is actually a polarizing issue that we try to avoid talking about democracy as Western, non-Western, in that sense. But for sure, I remember that politicians were talking to many experiences, South Africans, Latin Americans, Spanish people, people from the former Eastern Bloc, Communist Bloc.
So you were drawing lessons from democracies all over the world.
Exactly.
But it was still largely within that kind of representative democracy frame. And you're asking a little bit like what more might be possible.
Absolutely. Right. I think we took the good things from a representative democracy, but we immediately reproduced what was already happening in representative democracies. And I think the main challenge for us Tunisians then was to move from the subject story to the citizen story and not stick to the consumer story of the current representative democracy, to use your language.
Let's bring Johnny in before we go into that in a bit more depth. So, Johnny, you've been studying democratic backsliding around the world. You've been studying democratic skepticism. Like this story of what happened in Tunisia, how do you see that? Is that an encapsulation of democratic backsliding kind of everywhere? Is it different? How do we understand this moment?
So when an outsider like myself, unlike Omazin, reads or hears about the Tunisian experience, in many ways it feels exceptional because of the rate of change. Right? So you went from a revolution against autocracy to this kind of rapid process of democratization, turning into a process of democratic retreat, and then finally this return to autocracy. And all of this within around a decade, right? And that feels very exceptional. But if we take that arc, that general pattern, then that general pattern can be seen much more broadly on the global scale, right? So particularly after the Cold War, you saw this rapid expansion of democracy around the globe. There was much kind of hope. Academics were always talking about democratization. That was the big kind of word. And today, the big kind of word in the academic debate around democracy is backsliding. It's decline, is erosion. Right? So today, the average level of democracy for the average global citizen is back to a level that it was in 1978. Right. For the first time in two decades, there are more autocracies in the world than there are democracies. Right? So we've seen this very significant decline, and it's not been located in only one part of the world. Right? So Eastern Europe saw autocracies set in or worsen in Belarus and Hungary and Russia. In South Asia, you saw India, which was the world's most populous democracy, 1.5 billion people, downgraded from an electoral democracy to an electoral autocracy. We've seen democratic declines in Latin America, Western Europe, North America, and the United States. So the speed at which things happened in Tunisia was exceptional. But that arc, that pattern, we're seeing replicated at a more kind of global level. And the way in which the decline is happening also is replicated, right? There's always differences with context, but we're seeing this way in which democracy falls not by kind of revolutions, not by the military and the men with guns, right? But by this slow, incremental undermining of democratic processes, often by leaders who were elected, right? It was an elected leader in Tunisia who suspended parliament. Mm. And that is the case we see in many places which are experiencing democratic decline, right? It's the slow erosion of both what we call formal norms, right? So this is kind of your elections, your corruption bodies, your constitutional norms and courts, but also the erosion of those informal norms that support democracy. So politicians' commitment to the democratic process, to respecting elections, to playing not only by the rules, but the spirit of the rules, right? So not using every gap in the constitution for your own partisan political gain. Mm-hmm. All those kinds of things have been kind of slowly eroded, predominantly by people who came to power through elections, right? So there is a lot of patterns and a lot we can learn from looking at the kind of rapid microcosm of Tunisia for the broader experience of global backslide.
Just before we go into the contribution that democratic innovation might have made, I just want to linger in this thing about like the did democracy fulfill its promise, democracy as was? Like, to what extent is disillusionment with democracy a driver of this? Rather, so it's partly about politicians, elected politicians, exploiting for their own ends. But do you think there's a dynamic of disillusionment as well? Was that part of what happened in Tunisia? A feeling that jobs, freedom, and dignity had been promised but not fulfilled?
I mean, there were definitely demand. And then the hope, the expectation of people was that politicians would deliver and immediately. And, you know, a revolution doesn't happen overnight. Mm. So these problems have been slowly building over generations. And the lack of political freedoms and space for people and parties and organizations to come and criticize and propose alternatives ended up with a revolution that nobody expected. But still, you can see that there are grievances that were not taken into account by politicians. And so I think people had high expectations of democracy delivering immediately, which is not really the case. I mean, in democracy, you have elections, and the best case, I mean, the minimum, you have elections and you have to wait until political parties agree. But then in our case, we also needed to build the institutions for this new democracy. So it took longer for government to really be able to tackle the issues. And I think people saw that democracy was not delivering as fastly as they thought, and they lost hope. Because if revolution doesn't give you the answers, then democracy won't. They saw immediately, I think the perception of politicians also played a big role in a country where politicians were only seen as corrupt, serving their own needs, getting richer by stealing money. I mean, they didn't have any faith in the new politicians either, even if they saw new faces, newcomers, brave people who were fighting the dictatorship who finally came to power. They didn't believe that this new old class will deliver for them. Mm. So that's I think for me a main issue.
Yeah.
What works then?
Yeah.
And that's also, and this is my opinion, lots of people were looking at violence as a solution instead of peaceful protest after that.
This is actually one of the things you think perhaps democratic innovation, adopting new ways of doing democracy, might have helped with, by bringing people closer to the process, I think. Do you want to go into a bit more depth on what you think the dynamics of this sort of democratic disillusionment, the backsliding, the causes of backsliding were, and where you think democratic innovation could have made a difference?
Yeah, I'm thinking of democratic innovations because they have this fundamental belief in the agency, the power, the intelligence, and everything that a citizen could bring to a conversation. And this is really the framework where all these citizens who went to the street and liberated all Tunisians would have a formal, official, recognized and respected place, not as protesters in the street, not as voters coming in elections only, but as active contributors to the policy conversations at all levels of government. And I think that's a huge shift in paradigm for all politicians in Tunisia, all over the world for sure. We're not exceptional in that. Politicians still perceive citizens this way in most places as protesters or voters. But active participants, is that what I think, that's what we missed, because we had so much energy, so much beautiful ideas that needed to be channeled. And I personally understood very quickly that I needed to join a political party if I wanted my ideas to be taken seriously. If I wanted to influence the new social contract, I needed to run for parliament. If I wanted to change the laws, maybe I needed to have a position in government. There was no other space inside the change. And lots of people also decided to stay away from that and being inside the game. They decided, and that was also beautiful to witness, to start organizations, to monitor elections, to care about issues that were very important, but to stay outside. And I felt that this new energy was not strong enough to push politicians. But if we had that framework, that idea of seeing people as citizens, and if we had created spaces for deliberative processes, for participation, then we would have used that, like, I was going to say a gray area. It's not inside, it's not outside. Created that space for people to safely involve in the process without being immediately associated to politicians that they have perceived as corrupt, but also official channels where this collective intelligence could have been harnessed to feed into the reflections and the debates and the extraordinary work that was being done at the national level at the Constituent Assembly.
Fascinating stuff. So, and maybe let's bring that to life a little bit. In the work that you and Johnny have been doing, you go specifically into the case study of national tax reform. Do you want to tell us a bit more about how that actually was dealt with, and how you imagine it might have been that could have brought this kind of agency of citizens in a bit more?
Yeah, I was directly involved in that process in 2013 and 2014, and I was senior advisor to the Minister of Finance then. And there was truly a will to involve as many people as possible. But I don't think people in the sense of citizens was meant, but more the institutions. And because we didn't know how long we would be in government, the transition was changing all the time. And because we still wanted to have our contribution to a fairer system, simpler system, and also to kind of make sure that we have a truly progressive system, we looked at what was existing and maybe never formally used, but or truly used in a participatory way. And there was the Conseil National de la Fiscalité, National Council for Fiscality or Tax, that had representatives from trade union, business associations, consumers organization, ministries. And we tried to have meetings there and working groups that were as participatory as possible in a system that was still representative and not including lots of citizens. And so I think that worked at some point, like to some point, because we really had a lot of experts coming in, but people were still outside. That was still perceived as a technical issue and not a societal cause to kind of bring together. And people are still upset about the fiscal system, about paying taxes, and they know that there is a lot of tax avoidance and tax evasion. And so we didn't include, we missed that point there either. But I think we did our best in that short amount of time.
Yeah. And how would you imagine if you were an advisor to the Minister of Finance, maybe you were, if you'd been the most influential advisor and you knew all the things you knew now, what might you have done, do you think?
I think I would have done a National Citizens Assembly on tax fairness. The question that we had, like we really established beautiful and aspirational goals, a simple, fair and modern tax system. We would have asked the question to randomly selected citizens representing all, you know, aspects of Tunisian society, from rural to city to gender to a level of education, demographic. And we would have asked them the question. And they would have been the ones to call on experts, on organizations, international and national contributions, see what worked and doesn't work in other countries. and they would have made a decision and the government would have had to execute. That would have been my dream.
And what do you think would have been different as a result of that in how democracy was perceived in the country?
I think that would have made, first of all, people, citizens, look at government in a different way. They would have understood the complexity of dealing with such an incredible, complicated system. They would have understood the challenges. They would have understood where dictatorship had left us, but concretely not in what they heard or what they know without being involved in administration. They would have understood the challenges of civil servants, and they would have followed thoroughly the politicians and what has been implemented. And they would have been able to ask and question the politicians and also elect politicians accordingly. I think what would have also fundamentally changed is that they would have trusted the process. They would have trusted that we were trying to do our best, and they would have created that link between people who were not involved in the process and heard only about it, and the politicians who just are perceived that they're doing still their own propaganda.
Johnny, I want to come to you. How do you see this? So we've taken this example of tax specifically, but also more broadly, like this the role of citizens in Tunisia went from protesters to voters, little in between. Would you agree that democratic innovation could have made a major difference? And how does it need to evolve to maximize the contribution it makes?
So I don't think, though, myself or Omazin would tell you that a democratic innovation would have saved Tunisian democracy on its own, right? These are not silver bullets, right? These are not substitutes for good constitutional safeguards, right? For the independence of institutions, for public support, for democracy. But I do think there is an opportunity for these kind of institutions to play a role in this context, in helping to build forms of democratic resilience, right? So many of the problems that Tunisia faced during its process of democratization, these are problems that linger and fester. Right? They don't produce a return to autocracy overnight. So you need to be able to intervene earlier on in order to stop them turning into an issue, which then brings an end to democracy. Right? And research that looks at processes of autocratization shows that the earlier you can intervene, the earlier you can stop it, the better. Right, the more you allow autocratization to lock itself in, the harder it is to push back. Right, so I think democratic innovations might be able to play a role at that earlier stage. And what's really interesting in talking to Omazin is when she raises the kinds of problems that were faced in the transition, many of them map onto what we normally think about as an advantage of democratic innovations. Right, so take the limited economic reform, which included the tax situation, but much more broadly. Right, this was a big part of the revolution, right? People were demanding this, but there was a failure of the institutions to take those public demands and actually put it into legislation, actually make those necessary reforms. There was a disconnect between what the elites thought were important and what the public thought were important. Well, democratic innovations have a real virtue here because they bring ordinary people into government, right? Government people tend to be from certain backgrounds. Right. This is true of Tunisia. This is true of the UK. It's true of almost every democracy. Right. These tend to be educated people from better backgrounds, and they have a certain set of perspectives where certain problems feel more urgent to them. Democratic innovations bring perspectives into government that are not normally there, and therefore problems that might otherwise get marginalized can come in. Omazin has talked a lot about the complexity that was faced in the transition. Right. You're going from decades of authoritarianism to a completely new political system, having to deal with decades of clientelism, right, of a tax system that has just been tweaked in every possible way to favor the supporters of the regime, right? Dealing with these things is highly complex. While democratic innovations are often seen as helping to deal with complexity, right? Both because they can bring away in new ways of thinking, because they bring ordinary people who think about problems in different ways. And because they create different visions of labor. It's a new source of problem solving that's not already there. Building trust. Trust was lacking in Tunisia. democratic innovations could help to build trust. There was dominance of a religious cleavage in Tunisia. Democratic innovations could help to moderate polarization and bring other issues into the debate. So the problems often point towards these virtues. And we can talk about the limitations as well, but this is a really interesting link between what were the problems in those cases and what we think of as beneficial about democratic innovations. And that's quite surprising, right? You would think the democratic innovations, their virtues would have something to play in this kind of context.
I really like the way you talked about that, this sort of early intervention. It's almost like, it reminds me, there's a lovely Danish organization called Democracy Fitness. And they have a model of 10 different democracy muscles that they create training courses for. But there's a sense that actually, the way you talk about it, Omazine, it's almost like the democracy fitness of Tunisia could have been built over that 10-year period more effectively with these democratic innovations built in. It's not like, as you say, Johnny, it's not a silver bullet that would have gone, great, we've headed off autocracy. It's more that there's the work of coming out of autocracy and into democracy is one of kind of a deeper cultural shift that needs that these sorts of innovations, these sorts of processes can feed into and be part of. Is that how you think of it, Omazine?
Yeah. And at the same time, democratic innovations have been created for weird context.
Okay.
Right? And weird here is an acronym for wealthy, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic countries. Even though we know that lots of democratic innovation also happening in global majority countries, and participatory budgeting was invented in Brazil, but they're mainly based on transparency, on visibility of these processes, of openness to dialogue. That and these like three elements or prerequisites, if you will, are not necessarily true or present in post-dictatorship environment. People, even though they are freed from oppressive regime, you don't change your upbringing, your education, of not speaking up, of not being open to others, trust a group. You really have to understand that in Tunisia we were raised with like a policeman in our head. That's a little metaphor we use to explain how censorship works. You don't even allow yourself to think of the idea that emerges. So you repress it even in your own head before even you speak it. So there is even a step that comes before speaking. Your idea is you don't accept the ideas in your own mind. So that is something that we need, like the destroying our own censorship is a first step that needs to be added to allow people to speak openly and to express their ideas.
So what I think Omazine is pointing to is the real significant challenge here, which is how do you get democratic innovations to work effectively in a backsliding context, which is in many ways inhospitable to them. So I talked before about how many of the problems during the democratization process pointed towards virtues of democratic innovations. Well, many of the problems that happened when you start to see that retreat of democracy also point to the risks and the vices of democratic innovations. So if we think about something like a normal challenge to democratic innovations, even in the weird world, which is something like instrumentalization, right? What if politicians instrumentalize citizens' assemblies to only commission them when it's useful to them, to only follow their recommendations when they like the answers, right? To use it to
frame the questions to be what they want,
yes,
to
use it to produce their own legitimacy, right? When it's helpful to them, but not actually to follow what people want in some way. So that is a problem for democratic innovations, you know, the world over. In a backsliding context, right? When you have actors who are explicitly anti-democratic. Right. This is not a context where there is a background assumption that we all play by the democratic game. Right. Here we have actors who actually are trying to erode those democratic norms, who have no commitment to democracy. How might they instrumentalize the use of democratic innovations? right? May they try to use them in ways that can enhance their legitimacy, perhaps to go against the more general popular will of elections by saying, well, we formed this assembly, right? And this was real people, even though we tweaked it to make sure that it was people who supported us, right? These are real dangers. Think about another challenge that affects democratic innovations more generally, the trade-off between transparency and privacy, right? So on one hand, we want democratic innovations to generally be transparent. We want their decisions to be known to the public. We want their deliberations and reasoning to be known. We don't want this to be a black box, a secret assembly within government. But on the other hand, we want to protect the citizen members of these citizens' assemblies or participatory budgeting institutions, because they're not public individuals. These are not politicians who signed up to be in the public eye, right? To have people scroll through their social media looking for dirt, right? They're not people who have taken up that role. This is normal people, right? Who have been asked to do a public service. So there's this way of trying to trade off the transparency versus that privacy. Draw that to a situation of democratic backsliding, where the members of the Senate Assembly not only have this concern of being, you know, perhaps ending up in a newspaper or having a being on the wrong end of a Twitter storm, but also have really legitimate concerns about the extent to which the government is really committed to protecting them, protecting their freedom of speech, or freedom of association. It might actually make reprisals if they say the wrong thing. Right, that would be a genuine fear of people in Tunisia at that moment, and it would be a justified fear. So how do we deal with these kinds of cases, right? And that comes back to your question before, which I failed to answer, which is how do we transform democratic innovations to suit this inhospitable context, right? And I think that's the real challenge, right? So we should think about different ways in which we can do this. So on transparency versus privacy, we might have really good reasons to put lots more weight on the privacy, which we would not normally think is acceptable, right, in a kind of established democracy context. But here it may actually be necessary, right? Maybe we need to treat citizens' assemblies in a bit how we treat juries, right? Juries in criminal trials get anonymity. They get a significant level of privacy in a serious trial with public attention. You know, real steps are taken to protect the safety of that jury. Perhaps we need to start thinking about them like that in this context. When it comes to instrumentalization, well, you know, that's also a problem, of course, which confronts elections, right? Dictators like many autocracies are electoral autocracies. They like legitimacy that elections give them, even if they're, you know, corrupt elections. And ways we try and deal with that are things like having independent electoral commissions, right? From either independent institutions within the country or external to the country to try to guide them, to run them, to make sure they run by the correct standards. Perhaps we still need to start thinking about that in terms of democratic innovations, right? So not relying on the traditional state institutions that you might in a weird context rely on, thinking about these different ways of doing it, right? But that's the real challenge. How can we get those virtues to work in a context which is quite inhospitable to those virtues?
So as I'm hearing this, what we're saying is that the thought experiment of if we had had these things available in this time of building democracy in Tunisia, there we can see like real power and potential in building that democratic fitness, building that democratic resilience, getting to more of the kinds of reforms that were called for by that line of jobs, freedom and dignity. And we can also see that there are challenges to those working on democratic innovation to evolve the strategies, the processes, not be too dogmatic about some of the ways of working that tend to be taken as best practice at the moment from the context where maybe much of the work has been done to date. So this feels like really fascinating work. I know that you guys are still in the process of pinning down some of your conclusions, but the paper will be coming out soon. Before I just ask you where people can follow you and keep track and maybe hear more, is there like one kind of key learning I'd like to ask both of you? I mean, what one thing that you would love that you're sort of reflecting on most as a result of doing this work so far, maybe for the Tunisian context, Omazin, and then more broadly, Johnny?
I'm reflecting a lot on the role of people and how they can become leaders and what's this transformation that happened during those first days, first months, post-Tunisian revolution, a lot of people had ideas and wanted to implement them, and they immediately positioned themselves in the public sphere. But a lot stayed out of the decision-making process because the system was not adapted to welcome different walks of life, but also that, I mean, by that, politicians and others by choice, because they didn't want to have their hands dirty of being in charge somehow. And so I'm thinking, what needs to happen to reassure people that it's safe enough to contribute and to be somehow leading the process without that risk of being associated, or as we see now happening in Tunisia, retroactively be punished for an opinion that you published, you expressed publicly, or a decision you made as a civil servant or a politician. All are now in the same bucket. The witch hunt that didn't happen post-revolution is happening today in Tunisia. And so I'm thinking, what can we plan for the future, both in terms of, you know, as I said, future security, but what also are the skills that need to happen? I definitely think that democratic innovation, knowledge and expertise and experience need to be there from the beginning when the next wave of change will happen in Tunisia, because I believe it's going to happen. It's just a question of time, a matter of time. And so how can we create like a group or community or a collective or different sorts of collectives of people who know about these practices, but at the same time reflect about our own context of post-dictatorship and all the issues that Johnny talked about. And so we have a non-weird democratic innovation that provides really the space for everyone really to feel safe to contribute. And I think that will be an incredible addition to really build more resilience. It won't be the silver bullet that we all need. It's still experimentation. We are really building the first democracy in the Arab and Muslim world. So context matters. And so the question remains also for politicians. For me, not only the groups and the collective of citizens, but also politicians or people who aspire to lead the next transition phase of Tunisia need to know about democratic innovation. So how can we make these processes known? How can they debate them, criticize them, but learn about them and consider them as a tool in their hands? Because I don't believe that can happen only from citizens, from organizing, from grassroots, but it also needs to happen from institutions who open up to the citizens, the citizen power.
When it comes to the global level, the thing that's I've really taken away by learning more about the Tunisian experience is the importance of the relationship between democratic decline and backsliding and democratization. So when we first started speaking to each other and thinking about democratic innovations in a time of backsliding, the assumption was we'll be thinking about the end of this Tunisian arc that we've talked about, right? It'll be about the part where it starts to slip away into autocracy. But actually, many of the problems that Omazin identifies are in the earlier stages, are in that democratization stage. And when we look at the global level, although I spoke earlier about this kind of general democratic decline at the global level, it's not universal. Right. Most countries have not seen significant declines. Sorry, most democracies have not seen significant declines. And actually, we find surprising evidence, even about some of the worst cases, well, most serious cases of autocratization, about the ability of democracy to come back. So if we think about democratic breakdowns, so countries that have really lost the democratic institutions over the last 30 years, 54% of those cases in the last 30 years have returned to democracy, right? And that's quite an amazing figure, because we're not talking about every country that's just had some problems of decline, some problems of norm aversion. We're talking about the most serious cases where there's been a proper breakdown in democratic institutions. Over half return. So when we look to the future, I think we're looking not just at a kind of future of erosion, we're looking at a future of kind of instability, of moving back and forth between times of decline, times of democratization. So in addressing that problem, yes, we need to think about how you fight back in times of decline, how you do kinds of democratic self-defense, but also how do we do the democratization bits better so that when you have increases in democratic quality, those are not lost in the future. So a lot of attention is on the decline part, but it's both that will become really important moving forward. Yeah.
And it makes me think of countries like Hungary at the moment and what might be possible there. There's yeah. huge amounts of work to be done that can draw from this. This is very exciting work. I hope you'll get it done and out into the world very soon. Can you tell us just a little bit more about where people can follow you and find out more and maybe read the paper when you publish?
Okay, about the paper, we're going to publish it on Manchester University website.
That's the hope.
Then if they want to follow me, I have a personal website, omezinkhalifa.com, and my LinkedIn, same. And I'm going to probably publish also the paper there. And you have your own website too.
Yeah, my website is Dr. Jonathan Benson .co.uk. You can also find me on the University of Manchester's website. And yeah, everything I'm working on can be found in those places.
This was How to Save Democracy, the podcast for people who love democracy, but know we've got serious work to do to save it. This episode was hosted by John Alexander and me, Omezin Khalifa, and produced by Joe Barrett.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you want to get closer, find us online at howtosavedemocracy.co and sign up to the mailing list. We've got big plans, so if you can chip in to help us make them happen, we'd love to have you on board.